Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I feel truly honoured to be in conversation with a writer I've grown up with and long admired, Margaret Drabble. Awarded a DBE in 2008 for services to literature, she needs little introduction, and her prizes and honorary doctorates are too numerous to mention without taking up the entire podcast. Her first novel, A Summer Birdcage, was published in 1963 when she was 25, and since then she's written 18 novels, as well as books about Wordsworth, Thomas Hardy, Angus Wilson, Arnold Bennett and more. But today, as a way into talking about her life and work, we're going to be talking about her beautifully written new book, The Great Good Places. Margaret Drabble, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
Thank you.
Now, can we start with your book? Because in 2024, you told John Wilson on This Cultural Life that you would never finish this book in your lifetime. So what happened?
Well, I haven't finished it. This is just little bits of extracts. I mean, the book that I am writing is a proper memoir, and this is little bits of extracts from the memoir and also other stories that I was writing at the same time. So the book I was talking about to John Wilson will indeed never be finished in my lifetime.
Why do you say with such certainty that your memoir, that you will never finish it?
Well, because I keep on writing it, and and I don't want to publish it in my lifetime. I will leave it for my sons to edit, yes.
Now, I love this book because the way into so many of the chapters was places. And can we start with the place you grew up, Sheffield?
Well, I was born in Sheffield, but we were almost immediately evacuated because of the war, and it was very heavily bombed. So we moved out to a small town in South Yorkshire and moved back up after the war. And so I spent my sort of early school days and some of my teenage years there, which are very impressionable years and very formative. So I have very, very strong memories of Sheffield, which was very... It was a bomb site, really, when we went back, when I was 5 or 6 years old. And it was redeveloped. And I do go back as often as I can. If I'm invited, I'll tend to try and go. Because although it's changed enormously, some bits of it are exactly the same as they always were. The street where I lived, the avenue, is almost exactly the same as it was. Those 1920s Victorian mix, they don't change very much.
Tell us about Bryn.
My mother's parents bought that house in the 1930s, and they were from Mexborough in the Yorkshire coal fields. And I think my grandfather was the electrician at the gas works, and I think he didn't much enjoy life at the gas works. And they had this dream of running a sort of little tea room, and they bought this house, which is on the Great North Road. It's been bypassed now, but which was a lovely house and a very, very pretty village. And so that was a pleasure for us to go there, and my parents used to leave us with my aunt and my grandparents, and those were lovely holidays, really, really beautiful holidays, just playing in the field and talking all night and that kind of thing. It was good fun.
When you say talking all night, you did grow up in an amazingly intellectually active household, didn't you?
Yes, my parents did never talk to us, but we sisters talked to each other. And
you've got two sisters.
I have two sisters, and so we talked a lot, and yes, that was good. And I think it was the only time when my younger sister and I shared a bedroom, and I used to read a lot of Shakespeare to her, and she loved that. And so I have very happy memories of being a child.
Your older sister, Antonia Byatt, more famously known as the writer A.S. Pike. What does your younger sister do?
My younger sister is an art historian.
And your parents wrote, is that right?
My mother didn't write at all. I mean, she kept saying if she had time, she would. But my father did write. He published two detective stories when he retired from being a county court judge. And they were rather good, I thought. I mean, they were both published. The second of them, which is set in Filey, the seaside resort that we went to, is really very good. I enjoyed and admired it. So,
and what took you from acting to writing? Because tell our listeners about your time at Cambridge.
In those days, the theatre in Cambridge was very, very lively. There was a lot going on. Our contemporaries were Derek Jacobi, Ian McKellen, Eleanor Bron. Peter Hall had just finished his directorial stint there. So there was a lot going on in the theatre. My first husband, Clive Swift, was a wonderful actor. And so it was a very, very lively place to be in terms of theatre life. And a lot of people did go on from Cambridge to the Royal Shakespeare Company.
But you went on to act as well.
I did. I went on. It was a bit of luck for me because I married Clive in 1960, I think, just after I'd taken my degree. And Clive was already in the Royal Shakespeare Company. So I went to live in Stratford with him. And Peter Hall, who was the director, had a policy of employing families, and he really liked husbands and wives to be there together, and so he took me into the company as a walk-on and an understudy, and those were happy days.
So how did you start writing?
I wrote my first book in Stratford because Clive was out every evening. I mean, he was on stage every evening, and I was quite bored in the evenings. I didn't really know a lot of people in Stratford. So I thought, what shall I do to occupy myself? And so I wrote my first novel. I mean, it was quite easy going, really. I just thought, I'll write a novel. And to my astonishment, it was published. And after that, I had been in as a walk-on in the Royal Shakespeare Company. And it was just an easier life. I had one child, another on the way. And somehow writing books fitted in better with
all of that life. Juggling, they call it nowadays.
Frankly, juggling with the theatre wasn't so easy because you had to be on stage and so you had to have a babysitter and all that kind of thing. And whereas writing, you can do it anywhere, or I could.
But did the fact that you could, and indeed so it has been shown time and time again, did that take you by surprise?
No, I was very lucky. I mean, it all just happened for me. And I think I remember sort of beginning this first novel and in the first person, and it's a very kind of casual narrative voice, and it was unlike anything I'd been doing at Cambridge, which were kind of literary essays and sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, and I realised that with a novel format you could just say whatever you wanted and no one was going to stop you, and that was fun to do, so I sort of found the voice quite early, and on it went.
Interestingly, talking about doing English at Cambridge, I'm always amazed that people have the nerve to take to creative writing after we were taught the skills of practical criticism and how to wield that scalpel with such absolute horrific accuracy. And if you can ever turn that on yourself, I don't know how anyone has the nerve to write a line.
That is so interesting, what you say, because you just have to forget all of that.
Yes.
You have completely to forget. And somehow, if you start writing in the voice of a young woman rather than in the voice of an academic, it's kind of easy. Because you're not having to qualify yourself, you're not having to please any instructor, you can just do what you want. And I think having made that step, I felt I was free.
I'd love to talk a bit about the last novel that you wrote, The Dark Flood Rises, because it's such an exquisite novel about ageing. and all the things everybody worries about as they're getting older and facing mortality and relationships. And there are so many voices, and I felt a lot of them were quite autobiographical, and I wondered about that, especially about the friendship with the girl in the cellar.
Oh, yeah, so that's interesting. That was. It is true that the children who... That we did live in Sheffield in houses with interconnecting cellars. I'd completely forgotten that bit. Mm. But it is true that we were very good friends with the children next door in a kind of underground way.
The Canary Islands. You love the Canary Islands. Oh, yes. Tell us all about the Canary Islands.
Well, my husband and I, we went to the Canary Islands year after year in February. We were introduced to them by my son, and his son, who was then 2 and he's now 32, so it must be 30 years ago. And I think Adam and my son Adam and his little boy and his wife had booked a holiday, and they said, why don't you come and stay in the hotel? And we did, and we absolutely loved it there. And so we went year after year with other people or by ourselves, and for a fortnight in February every year. Have you ever been to the Canaries?
No, I haven't. And thanks to you, I now am really curious to go.
My sister-in-law, who I absolutely loved, she was a wonderful woman, but she was very snobby about it. She said, I'm never going to go to the Canaries, it's just English pubs, which is not true. It's not. And the landscape, it happened to appeal to us. I just love that volcanic landscape. And the island we went to most often, Lanzarote, was... It wasn't high-rise, it was kept under control by this artist called César Manrúquez, who kind of, he did a lot of sculpture and architecture there. So Michael and I went there every year for 15 years, something like that. It was the last place we went to abroad together, just before lockdown.
Did you buy a house there ever, or you just...
No, we had a timeshare. I mean, the first time we went, we stayed in a hotel, which was very luxurious, and I mean, it was a mass hotel, but the food was excellent, and it was on the beach, and what's not to like? It was very, very nice. And so, but we did eventually go to all the islands. Lanzarote and Fuerteventura are kind of volcanic and sandy. Gomera is kind of... it's greener and it goes up very high and there's snow on the top. And the beaches are black. Tenerife is very, very mass tourism. And so is Gran Canaria. So the smaller islands are kind of better. But Lanzarote, it has very big hotel developments, but they're very well done. I mean, they're very well planned. And it's very... peaceful there. The roads are excellent. You can't get lost on an island. You can drive around. There were wonderful drives and volcanoes and walks. It was just a lovely, lovely, kind of very low-key kind of experience, and which I liked. It's not like going to Rome or Venice where you feel pressed.
FOMO. You have to do everything.
And that's exciting too. But the Canaries are kind of laid back.
So places. So I'm one of those people who am pathetically sentimental and nostalgic about places I've loved.
Yes.
And I daren't go back to some of them. You keep going back and you keep maintaining a relationship with them. And I'm really interested by that because I think especially as we age, we get wary. Yeah. And so can we talk about Filey?
Oh, yes. Mm. Now, Filey really hasn't been spoiled at all, in my view. I last went...
Tell our listeners where and what it is.
Filey is on the Yorkshire coast. It's between Bridlington and Scarborough, on the north-east coast of Yorkshire. And Bridlington has now become quite trippery. Scarborough is a sort of rather grand place. It was grand, then got seedy, but still is quite grand. But Filey is a fishing village, and it's between the two. And it considers itself more refined. And it was a delightful place. And we used to go for a whole month every summer because my father's chambers, he was a barrister, they closed. And he got the whole of August off. And this was just wonderful for us because we'd rent a little We usually rented a cottage. Occasionally there was somebody who did this evening meal for us. It varied. And we had our own bathing hut on the beach, a little canvas bathing hut where we changed and went for a swim. And it was just, the kind of repetition of it was just wonderful. And the last time I went to Fylie, and the piece in the book is about this visit, I think I was writing a piece about Fylie and about the Brontes.
Yes.
And so it was all just a pleasure to revisit and to see that things hadn't changed all that much. I mean, there's still the Coble Landing where the boats are, the amusement arcade, the little strip of grass along the front, the beach. It is all just beautiful. But what was odd was that we used to swim in the sea all the time. And in those days, the sewage was let straight into the sea. So you were bobbing around with all this effluent, which would horrify people now. I mean, quite rightly. But for some reason, it didn't bother us at all. But the sea was full of fish, the rock pools were full of shellfish. Everything was fine. So we didn't...
Well, there's effluent and then there's chemicals.
I think maybe it was just more innocent effluent. Yeah. I don't know.
But purer.
Purer. It was more organic.
Organic. Yeah.
I think it would maybe have been more organic rather than, yes. But certainly we didn't mind swimming in the sea at all. And it is a perfect day for swimming.
Where is your absolute all-time favourite place to go now?
Oh, dear, that's very hard to say because I don't go anywhere very much now. I did really love when we bought a house at Porlock Weir, which is still in the family, but I haven't been there for a year. I will go for a weekend, I hope, soon.
It's in Somerset.
It's in Somerset. We were the last house in Somerset, literally the last house. It was Devon over the border, and it was a very beautiful house. It was on the sea, it was on the Bristol Channel. And you could walk into the sea if you didn't mind the pebbles.
In the novel, not your latest book, you write a lot about older people facing mortality and death and experiencing death of loved ones and so on, thinking about where they are. I think that's really interesting. And obviously something you're coming to terms with a very ill husband and so on. London's it.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I do get out, but not very often, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so in terms of future writing now, you're going to keep working on your memoir.
Oh, yes, I just add bits to it when something strikes me. It's a good... It's in a way, it's turned into a kind of diary. I've never kept a diary.
But have you not?
Not
That's
really.
So interesting.
Not really, no. Yeah. I mean, I was too busy doing books. I mean, I didn't really have the time to do a diary as well. But I now do, if something strikes me or an incident strikes me, or if I remember something very peculiar, I will go to my endless script and add a few hundred words to it.
And how many words is it up to now? Is it huge?
I think it's about probably 200,000, something.
Goodness,
like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of it, but some of it's unpublishable and some of it is repetition. But it's a kind of place to go to when something has struck me, either very good, very bad, just something. And sometimes it's just a very small incident, like somebody I had a conversation with on the bus, that kind of thing. And you just want to put it down somewhere.
You know, I've heard you talk about how when your beloved daughter died, that was the end of fiction writing. Is that just because you can't or you won't or you don't want to? Or...
I don't want to write a novel.
No.
I have written a couple of short stories and I'm just about to begin another short story about something totally, totally different, which will be fun to do. But I don't want to write a novel because my sense of constructing a novel has seemed to have disappeared, and I don't have the time to concentrate. Life is sort of on hold in some ways, so I don't have the time by myself to think consecutively.
In terms of facing your mortality, which the novel was so much about, and I also heard you say, I think you said this on your cultural life, that you're incredibly at terms with your own death now.
I don't worry about dying very much at all, because, I mean, that's what happens. I worry about keeping things going. That's another matter altogether. But, one's friends die, and sometimes one thinks, well, that was a very peaceful way to die, and sometimes one thinks, well, it's a pity they had a lot of pain in the last month or two. But you just hope for peace, really.
Are you religious at all?
Not at all, no. I often have conversations with my friends about whether we're atheists or agnostics. And I think I'm an agnostic, because I think... I wouldn't say there is absolutely no God, but by God I don't mean a godly God. I mean some kind of prime mover. Something must have set it all going in the first place. Something started it all off. And whatever that is, we human beings may never know. But I don't feel that our world is all there is and our mortality is all there is, because there's space, there's what happened before the Big Bang. All those things are imponderably huge, and our brains aren't up to coping with them.
So death need not necessarily be total blackout in the end.
It probably is, but it could be that you just join the cosmos. I mean, we're all part of the cosmos. We're always being told that we're all made of stardust and all that kind of stuff, and that at the Big Bang everything was there and it all came down into us. Well, that's probably true. We'll go back into all of that.
Well, before any of us do that, if you look back on your life, is there anything you wish you'd done differently, or is there anything you feel, oh, wish I'd done that?
No, I think I took the risks I wanted to take,
yes,
and I did the things I wanted to do, and I think the decisions I've made about big things like buying or selling houses, on the whole, it's worked out well. And I have to say that I'm immensely grateful to my husband, Michael, for teaching me to drive. He was so patient and so good.
When did you learn to drive?
When I was 40-something.
I
failed my test twice, once with my father and once with my first husband, Clive, who was a hopeless teacher. She got so cross with me. But Michael just sat in the car and I drove around Somerset and then. And it has been, it's true that he possibly taught me because he knew it would be useful to him in time to come. Because you don't want to spend your entire time driving your wife from A to B. And I was able to drive him from A to B. But that things like the... I can't remember how we got on to this, but the things that happen to you that are pure advantage, really. I mean, that you learn to do things that you thought you couldn't do. Somebody said to me recently that she'd learnt to swim quite late in life and how wonderful that was. And I think that these things that we can discover enrich our lives.
I think that's so interesting, because a lot of people I know, my mother, for example, she was almost a fear of freedom thing.
Right.
In later life, she suddenly became terrified of driving and stopped being able to do it.
I know people who've stopped.
Yes, I think that's really interesting. And you've gone completely the other way.
It is interesting. I mean, I do have conversations with people about how long we're going to go on driving. And one of the people I've had this conversation with is Joan Bakewell, who has frequently said she's going to go on driving as long as she can. But I think Joan has stopped driving now. But she was quite right. She said it just is such a liberating thing to be able to drive up to Primrose Hill and sit and look at the view and then drive home again.
Quite agree.
And it's some there are things like that that do open up a bit of your life. Mm. You know, most of the things close down, but some things open up.
So, anything else that you're still to do?
No, I can't think of anything. I mean, I don't want to go to places anymore because it's so difficult to get there. But I will go to Somerset once more, certainly. So I don't have any grand travel plans. I don't go to the theatre now because it's so uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I find it clambering over people's feet and not being able to get to the loo, that kind of thing, a kind of difficult when you're my age. Whereas the cinema is much easier because the cinema is better designed because they're built later. I mean, I do have friends because I know a lot of people in the theatre profession who still go a lot, and they could try and persuade me to go with them, but it's uncomfortable and it's slightly stressful for me. Whereas going to the cinema isn't stressful at all. I mean, if you don't like it, you can just walk out. It is quite interesting how, as you get to my age, comfort matters, and you work out which ways you can go on public transport that aren't going to involve a lot of walking. Though, at my age, the dreaded phrase is, buses on diversion, next bus stop is closed. And you think, oh,
I have to speed on one of those.
Well, it strikes terror to the heart, because you never know how you're going to get out of it. And sometimes you have to walk half a mile. I don't like that at all. On the other hand, I do enjoy London transport, and I enjoy watching people and people talking on the bus. And it's sort of... It's quite an adventure sometimes going on the bus, because on the whole, most people are friendly and enjoying themselves and having a good time.
What about restaurants? Because this is a great bugbear amongst oldies, is the noise.
The noise is terrible.
Yeah.
I quite agree. No, I sometimes have lunch with my brother and sister and brother-in-law. I can't hear a lot of what they're saying. But we did find a very, very nice, quiet place, which I won't recommend to anybody, because I don't want anyone else going there. But it is very quiet, and the food is okay.
Is it upholstered? Because I think that's...
It's upholstered. Mm. And it's usually not absolutely packed. Mm. But it is... It's you can hear every word, and that makes a big difference. I look now for kind of soft furnishing.
Yes,
and there are one or two hotels in particular sometimes have a nice dining room with soft furnishings, and they're absorbent and you're okay, and the kind of the tables aren't too close together. It's so interesting. I mean, there's one very person I'm very close to, and I just can't eat out with her anymore. We used to have lunches, but we can't. And I now go to her flat all the time because I can't hear what she says. No. And I love hearing what she says because I like her ideas and everything. But it's not enjoyable if you're sitting there.
No.
Unable to, and having to ask, what was that? Or could you say that again? It's not pleasant.
Well, I'm very sorry we're not going to be able to read your memoir, obviously, anytime soon. But thank you so much. That was absolutely lovely conversation. Thank you very much indeed for being on Radio Aldi.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to say some of the things I've said.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalfe, in conversation with the great writer Margaret Drabble. If you've enjoyed this conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to you, Margaret Drabble, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL.